Chapter 7 Life in the Clearings versus the Bush by Susanna Moody. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.
On, forever brightly on, thy lucid waves are flowing, thy waters sparkle as they run, their long, long journey going.
We have rounded Ox Point, and Belleville is no longer in sight. The steamboat has struck into mid-channel, and the bold shores of the Prince Edward District are before us. Calmly we glide on, and islands and headlands seem to recede from us as we advance. And now they are far in the distance, half seen through the warm purple haze that rests so dreamily upon the woods and waters. Heaven is above us, and another heaven, more soft and not less beautiful, lies mirrored beneath. And within that heaven are traced exquisite forms of earth, trees, and flowers, and verdant slopes and bold hills, and barren rugged rocks. The scene is one of surpassing loveliness, and we open our hearts to receive its sweet influences, while our eyes rest upon it with intense delight, and the inner voice of the soul whispers, God is here. Dost thou not catch the reflection of his glory in this superb picture of nature's own painting, while the harmony that surrounds his throne is faintly echoed by the balmy wind that stirs the lofty branches of the woods, and the waves that swell and break in gentle undulation against these rocky isles?
So smiled the heavens on the vestal earth, the morn she rose, exulting from her birth, a living harmony, a perfect plan of power and beauty, ere the rebel man, defiled with sin and stained with kindred blood, the paradise his God pronounced as good.
That rugged point to the left contains a fine quarry of limestone, which supplies excellent building materials. The stones are brought by the means of a scow, a very broad, flat-bottomed boat, to Belleville, where they are sawn into square blocks and dressed for door-sills and facings of houses. A little further on, the Salmon River discharges its waters into the bay, and on its shores the village of Shannonville has risen, as if by magic, within a very few years. Three schooners are just now anchored at its mouth, receiving cargoes of sawn lumber to carry over to Oswego. The timber is supplied from the large mill, the din of whose machinery can be heard distinctly at this distance. Lumber forms, at present, the chief article of export from this place. Upwards of 1,000,000 of sawn lumber was shipped from this embryo town during the past year. Shannonville owes its present flourishing prospects to the energy and enterprise of a few individuals, who saw at a glance its capabilities and purchased for a few hundred pounds the site of a town which is now worth as many thousands. The steamboats do not touch at Shannonville in their trips to and from Kingston. The mouth of the river is too narrow to admit a larger vessel than a schooner, but as the place increases, wharfs will be built at its entrance into the bay. On the road leading from Belleville to this place, which is in direct route to Kingston, there is a large tract of plain land which is still uncultivated. The soil is sandy, and the trees are low and far apart, a natural growth short grass and flowering shrubs giving it very much the appearance of a park. Clumps of butternut and hickory trees form picturesque groups, and herds of cattle belonging to the settlers in the vicinity roam at large over these plains that sweep down to the water's edge. This is a very favorite resort of summer parties, as you can drive light carriages in all directions over this elevated platform. It used, formerly, to be a chosen spot for camp meetings, and all the piously disposed came hither to listen to the preachers and get religion. I never witnessed one of these meetings, but an old lady gave me a very graphic description of one of them that was held on this spot some 30 years ago. There were no churches in Belleville then, and the traveling Methodist ministers used to pitch their tents on these plains and preach night and day to all goers and comers. A pulpit, formed of rough slabs of wood, was erected in a conveniently open space among the trees, and they took it by turns to read, exhort, and pray to the dwellers in the wilderness. At night they kindled large fires, which served both for light and warmth, and enabled the pilgrims to the sylvan shrine to cook their food and attend to their wants of the little ones. Large booths made of the boughs of trees sheltered the worshippers from the heat of the sun during the day, or from the occasional showers produced by some passing thundercloud at night. "Our bush farm," said my friend, "happened to be near the spot, and I went with a young girl, a friend and neighbor, partly of curiosity and partly out of fun, to hear the preaching. It was in the middle of July, but the weather was unusually wet for that time of year, and every tent and booth was crowded with men, women, and children, all huddled together to keep out of the rain. Most of these tents exhibited some extraordinary scene of fanaticism and religious enthusiasm. The noise and confusion were deafening. Men were preaching at the very top of their voice. Women were shrieking and groaning, beating their breasts and tearing their hair, while others were uttering the most frantic outcries, which they called ejaculatory prayers. One thought possessed me all the time, that the whole assembly were mad, and that they imagined God to be deaf, and that he could not hear them without their making this shocking noise. It would appear to you like the grossest blasphemy were I to repeat to you some of their exclamations. But one or two were so absurdly ridiculous that I cannot help giving them as I heard them. One young woman, after lying foaming and writhing upon the ground, like a creature possessed, sprang up several feet into the air, exclaiming, "I have got it! I have got it! I have got it!" To which others responded, "Keep it! Keep it! Keep it!" I asked a bystander what she meant. He replied, "She has got religion. It is the spirit that is speaking in her." I felt too much shocked to laugh out, yet could scarcely retain my gravity. Passing by one of the tents, I saw a very fat woman lying on a bench on her face, uttering the most dismal groans, while two well-fed, sleek-looking ministers, in rusty black coats and very dirty-looking white chokers, were drumming upon her fat back with their fists, exclaiming, "Here's glory! Here's glory, my friends! Satan is departing out of this woman! Hallelujah!" This spectacle was too shocking to provoke a smile. There was a young lady dressed in a very nice silk gown. Silk was a very scarce and expensive article in those days. The poor girl got dreadfully excited, and was about to fling herself down upon the wet grass, to show the depth of her humility and contrition, when she suddenly remembered the precious silk dress, and taking a shawl of less value from her shoulders, carefully spread it over the wet ground. "Ah, my dear friend," continued the old lady, "one had a deal to learn at camp meetings. A number of those people knew no more what they were about than persons in a dream. They worked themselves up to a pitch of frenzy, because they saw others carried away by the same spirit, and they seemed to try which could make the most noise, and throw themselves into the most unnatural positions. Few of them carried the religious zeal they manifested in such a strange way at that meeting into their own homes. Before the party broke up, it was forgotten, and they were laughing and chatting about their worldly affairs. The young lads were sparking the girls, and the girls laughing and flirting with them. I remarked to an old farmer, who was reckoned a very pious man, that such conduct in persons who has just been in a state of despair about their sins was very inconsistent, to say the least of it, and he replied with a sanctimonious smile, "It is only the Lord's lambs playing with each other." These camp meetings seldom take place near large towns, where people have the benefit of a resident minister, but they still occur on the borders of civilization, and present the same disorderly mixture of fanaticism and vanity. More persons go for a frolic than to obtain any spiritual benefit. In illustration of this, I will tell you a story which a very beautiful young married lady told to me with much glee, for the thing happened to herself, and she was the principal actor in the scene. I had an aunt, the wife of a very wealthy yeoman, who lived in one of the black townships of C. On the St. Lawrence, she was a very pious and hospitable woman, and none knew it better than the travelling ministers, who were always well fed and well lodged at her house, particularly when they assembled to hold a camp meeting, which took place once in several years in that neighbourhood. I was a girl of 15, and was staying with my aunt for the benefit of the country air, when one of these great gatherings took place. Having heard a great deal about their strange doing at these meetings, I begged very hard to be allowed to make one of the spectators. My aunt, who knew what a merry, light-hearted creature I was, demurred for some time before she granted my request. "If the child does not get religion," she said, "she will turn it all into fun, and it will do her more harm than good." Aunt was right enough in her conjectures, but still she entertained a latent hope that the zeal of the preachers, the excitement of the scene, and the powerful influence produced by the example of the pious might have a beneficial effect on my young mind and lead to my conversion. Aunt had herself been reclaimed from a state of careless indifference by attending one of these meetings, and at last it was determined that I was to go. First came the ministers, and then the grand feed my aunt had prepared for them, before they opened the campaign. Never shall I forget how those holy men devoured the good things set before them. I stood gazing upon them in utter astonishment, wondering when their meal would come to an end. They none wore whiskers, and their broad, fat faces literally shone with high feeding. When I laughed at their being such excellent knife and fork men, Aunt gravely reproved my levity by saying that the laborer was worthy of his hire, and that it would be a great sin to muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn, that field preaching was a very exhausting thing, and that these pious men required a great deal of nourishment to keep up their strength for the performance of good work. After they were gone, I dressed and accompanied my aunt to the scene of action. It was a lovely spot about a mile from the house. The land rose in a gentle slope from the river, and was surrounded on three sides by lofty woods. The front gave us a fine view of the St. Lawrence, rushing along in its strength, the distant murmur of the waves mingling with the sigh of the summer breeze that swept the dense foliage of the forest trees. The place had been cleared many years before, and was quite free from stumps and fallen timber, the ground carpeted with soft moss and verdant fresh-looking turf. The area, allotted for the meeting, was fenced around with the long, thin trunks of sapling trees, and they were tied together with strips of basswood. In the center of the enclosure was the platform for the preachers, constructed of rough slabs, and directly behind this rural pulpit was a large tent connected with it by a flight of broad steps. Here the preachers retired, after delivering their lectures, to rest and refresh themselves. Fronting the platform was a sort of amphitheatre of booths, constructed of branches of trees, and containing benches of boards, supported at either end by a round log, laid lengthwise at the sides of the tent. Behind these rough benches, persons had placed mattresses, which they had brought with them in their wagons, that such as came from a distance might not want for a bed during their stay, some of these meetings lasting over a week. The space without the enclosure was occupied by a double line of carts, wagons, light carriages, and ox sleds, while the animals, undivested of their harnesses, were browsing peacefully among the trees. The inner space was crowded with persons of all classes, but the poor certainly predominated. Well-dressed, respectable people, however, were not wanting. And though I came there to see and to be seen, to laugh and to make others laugh, I must confess that I was greatly struck with the imposing and picturesque scene before me, particularly when a number of voices joined in singing the hymn with which the service commenced. There is something very touching in this blending of human voices in the open air, this choral song of praise borne upwards from the earth and ascending through the clear atmosphere to heaven. Leaving my friend and her curious narrative for a few minutes, I must remark here the powerful effect produced upon my mind by hearing God Save the King sung by thousands of London on the proclamation of William IV. It was impossible to distinguish good or bad voices in such a mighty volume of sound, which rolled through the air like a peal of solemn thunder. It thrilled through my heart and paled my cheek. It seemed to me the united voice of a whole nation rising to the throne of God, and it was the grandest combination of sound and sentiment that ever burst upon human ears. Long, long may that thrilling anthem rise from the heart of England in strains of loyal thanksgiving and praise to the throne of that eternal potentate in whose hand is the fate of princes. There were a number of persons who, like myself, came there for amusement, and who seemed to enjoy themselves quite as much as I did. The preaching at length commenced with a long prayer, followed by an admonitory address, urging those present to see their danger, repent of their sins, and flee from the wrath to come. Toward the middle of his discourse, the speaker wrought himself up into such a religious fury that it became infectious, and cries and groans resounded on all sides, and the prayers poured out by repentant sinners for mercy and pardon were heart-rending. The speaker at length became speechless from exhaustion, and stopping suddenly in the midst of his too eloquent harangue, he tied a red cotton handkerchief round his head, and hastily descended the steps, and disappeared in the tent, provided for the accommodation of the ministers. His place was instantly supplied by a tall, dark, melancholy-looking man, who, improving upon his reverend brother's suggestions, drew such an awful picture of the torments endured by the damned, that several women fainted, while others were shrieking in violent hysterics. I had listened to the former speaker with attention and respect, but this man's violent denunciations rather tended to harden my heart and make me resist any religious feeling that had been growing up in my breast. I began to tire of the whole thing, and commenced looking about for some object that might divert my thoughts into a less gloomy channel. The bench on which I, together with a number of persons, was sitting, was so insecurely placed on the round rolling logs that supported it, that I perceived that the least motion given to it at my end would capsize it, and bring all the dear groaning creatures who were sitting upon it, with their eyes turned up to the preacher, sprawling on the ground. "Would it not be glorious fun?" whispered the spirit of mischief, perhaps the old one himself, in my ears. "I can do it, and I will do it, so here goes." As I sat next to the round log that supported my end of the plank, I had only to turn my face that way and apply my foot like a lever to the round trunk on which the end of the bench had the slightest possible hold, and the contemplated downfall became a certainty. No sooner thought than done. The next moment, young and old, fat and lean, women and children lay sprawling together on the ground in the most original attitudes and picturesque confusion. I, for my part, was lying very comfortably on one of the mattresses, laughing until real tears, but not of contrition, streamed down my face. Never shall I forget a fat old farmer who used to visit at my aunt's as he crawled out of the human heap on all fours and shook his head at me.
"You young sinner, this is all your doings!"
Before the storm cloud burst upon me, I got up and ran laughing out of the tent, and hid myself among the trees to enjoy my wicked thoughts alone. Here I remained for a long time, watching at a safe distance the mad gesticulations of the preacher, who was capering up and down on the platform, and using the most violent and extravagant language, until at length, overcome by his vehemence, he too tied the invariable red handkerchief around his head, and tumbled back into the tent, to be succeeded by another and another. Night, with all her stars, was now stealing upon us, but the light from a huge pile of burning logs, and from the torches, composed of fat pine, and stuck in iron grates, supported on poles in different parts of the plain, scattered the darkness back to the woods, and made it as light as noonday. The scene was now wild in the extreme. The red light streamed upon the moving mass of human beings, who pressed around the pulpit, glaring upon clenched fists and upturned faces, while the preacher standing above them, and thrown into strong relief, with his head held back and his hands raised towards the heaven, looked like some inspired prophet of old, calling down fire from heaven to consume the ungodly. It was a spectacle to inspire both fear and awe, but I could only view it in the most absurd light and laugh at it. At length I was determined to know what became of the preachers after tying the red handkerchief round their heads and retreating to their tents. I crept carefully round to the back of this holy of holies, and applying my eyes to a little aperture in the canvas, I saw by the light of a solitary candle several men lying upon mattresses fast asleep, their noses making anything but a musical response to the hymns and prayers without. While I was gazing upon these prostrate forms, thus soundly sleeping after the hubbub and excitement their discourse had occasioned among their congregation, the last speaker hastily entered the tent, and flinging himself on the floor, exclaimed in a sort of ecstasy of gratitude,
"Well, thank God my task is ended for the night, and now for a good sleep."
While I was yet pondering these things in my heart, I felt the grasp of a hand upon my shoulder. I turned with a shriek. It was my aunt seeking me.
"What are you doing here?" she said, rather angrily.
"Studying my lesson, aunt," said I, gravely, pointing to the sleepers. "Do these men preach for their own honour and glory, or for the glory of God? I have tried to find out, but I can't tell."
"The night's grown chilly, child," said my aunt, avoiding the answer I expected. "It is time you were in bed."
We went home. I got a sound lecture for the trick I had played, and I never went to a camp-meeting again. Yet, in spite of my bad conduct as a child, I believe they often do good, and are the means of making careless people think of the state of their souls.
Though the steamboats do not stop at Shannonville, they never fail to do so at the pretty town of Northport, on the other side of the bay, in order to take in freight and passengers. Northport rises with a very steep slope from the water's edge, and the steamer runs into the wharf, which projects but a few feet from the shore. Down the long hill, which leads to the main street, men and boys are running to catch a sight of the steamboat and hear the news. All is bustle and confusion. Barrels of flour are being rolled into the boat, and sheep and cattle are led off. Men hurry on board with trunks and carpet bags, and women, with children in their arms or led by the hand, hasten on board, while our passengers, descending to the wharf, are shaking hands with merchants and farmers, and talking over the current prices of grain and merchandise at their respective towns. The bells ring. The cable that bounds us to the friendly wharf is cast off and flung on the deck. The steamer opens her deep lungs, and we are once more steaming our way towards Kingston. While we sail up that romantic part of the Bay of Quinte, called the Long Reach, at the head of which stands the beautiful town of Picton, I will give you a few reminiscences of Northport. It is a most quiet and primitive village, and one might truly exclaim with Moore, "And if I said there's peace to be found on the earth, the heart that is humble might hope for it here." No gentler picture of society in a new country could be found than the one exhibited by the inhabitants of Northport. The distinctions unavoidable among persons of wealth and education are hardly felt or recognized here. Every one is a neighbor in the strictest sense of the word, and high and low meet occasionally at each other's houses. Even the domestics are removed by such a narrow line of demarcation that they appear like members of one family. The Prince Edward District, one of the wealthiest rural districts in Upper Canada, was settled about 60 years ago by U.E. Loyalists, and its inhabitants are mainly composed of the descendants of Dutch and American families. They have among them a large sprinkling of Quakers, who are a happy, hospitable community, living in peace and brotherly kindness with all men. The soil of this district is of the best quality for agricultural purposes, and though the march of improvement has been slow, when compared with the rapid advance of other places that possess fewer local advantages, it has gone on steadily progressing, and the surface of a fine, undulating county is dotted over with large, well-cleared farms and neat farmhouses. One of the oldest and wealthiest inhabitants of Northport, Captain Blank, is a fine specimen of the old school of Canadian settlers, one of nature's gentlemen, a man respected and beloved by all who know him, whose wise head and keen organs of observation have rendered him a highly intelligent and intellectual man, without having received the benefit of a college education. His house is always open for the reception of friends, neighbors, and strangers. He has no children of his own, but has adopted several orphan children, on whom he has bestowed all the affection and care of a real parent. The system of adopting children in Canada is one of great benevolence, which cannot be too highly eulogized. Many an orphan child, who would be cast utterly friendless upon the world, finds a comfortable home with some good neighbor, and is treated with more consideration, and enjoys greater privileges than if his own parents had lived. No difference is made between the adopted child and the young ones of the family. It is clothed, boarded, and educated with the same care, and a stranger would find it difficult to determine which was the real, which was the transplanted scion of the house. Captain Blank seldom dines alone, someone is always going and coming, stepping in and taking potluck, by accident or invitation. But the captain can afford it. Sociable, talkative, and the soul of hospitality, he entertains his guests like a prince. "Is he not a glorious old fellow?" said our beloved and excellent Chief Justice Robinson. "Captain Blank is a credit to the country." We echoed this sentiment with our whole heart. It is quite a treat to make one of his uninvited guests, and share the good-humored sociability of his bountiful table. You meet there men of all grades and conditions, of every party and creed, the well-educated, well-dressed clergymen of the establishment, and the travelling dispensers of gospel truths, with shabbier coats and less pretensions. No one is deemed an intruder. All find excellent cheer and a hearty welcome. Northport does not want its native poet, though the money-making merchants and farmers regard him with a suspicious and pitying eye. The manner in which they speak of his unhappy malady reminds me of what an old Quaker said to me regarding his nephew, Bernard Barton. "Friend Susanna, it is a great pity, but my nephew Bernard is sadly addicted to literature." So Isaac N., gentleman farmer of the township of Ameliasburg, is sadly gifted with the genuine elements of poetry, and, like Burns, composes verses at the plough-tail. I have read with great pleasure some sweet lines by this rural Canadian bard, and were he now beside me, instead of Big Bay, lying so provokingly between, I would beg from him a specimen of his rhyming powers, just to prove to my readers that the genuine children of song are distinguished by the same unmistakable characteristics in every clime. I remember being greatly struck by an overcoat worn by a clergyman I had the pleasure of meeting many years ago at this village, which seemed to me a pretty good substitute for the miraculous purse of Fortunatus. The garment to which I allude was long and wide, and cut round somewhat in the shape of a spencer. The inside lining formed one capacious pocket, to which the reverend gentleman could conveniently stow away newspapers, books, and sermons, and, on a pinch, a fat fowl, a bottle of wine, or a home-baked loaf of bread. On the present occasion, the kind mistress of the house took care that the owner should not travel with it empty, so to keep him fairly balanced on his horse, she stowed away into this convenient garment such an assortment of good things that I sat and watched the operation in curious amazement. Sometime after, I happened to dine with a dissenting minister at Mr. Blank's house. The man had a very repulsive and animal expression. He ate so long and lustily of a very fat goose that he began to look very uncomfortable, and complained very much of being troubled with dyspepsy after his meals. He was a great teetotaler, or professed to be one, but certainly had forgotten the text, "Be ye moderate in all things," for he by no means applied the temperance system to the substantial creature comforts of which he partook in a most immoderately voracious manner. "I know what would cure you, Mr. R.," said my friend, who seemed to guess at a glance the real character of his visitor, "but then I know that you would never consent to make use of such a remedy." "I would take anything that would do me good," said the black coat with a sigh. "What do you think of a small wine glass of brandy just before taking dinner?"
"Against my principle, sir, I would never do it," with a lugubrious shake of the head.
"There is nothing on earth so good for your complaint."
"Do you really think it would serve me?"
with a sudden twinkle of his heavy, fishy eyes.
"Not a doubt of the fact," pouring out a pretty large dram. "It will kill the heartburn, and do away with that uncomfortable feeling you experience after eating rich food. And as to principles, your pledge allows it, in case of disease."
"True," said the black coat, coquetting with the glass. "Still, I should be sorry to try an alcoholic remedy while another could be found."
"Perhaps you would prefer eating less," said my friend slyly, "which I have been told by a medical man is generally a certain cure, if preserved in."
Yes, but, sir, my constitution would never stand that. I think for once I will try the effect of your first prescription, but remember it is only medicinally." The next moment the glass was returned to the table empty, and the good man took his leave. "Now, Mr. Blank, was it not too bad of you to make that man break his pledge?" observed a person at table. "My dear sir, that man requires very little temptation to do that. The total abstinence of a glutton is entirely for the public."
The houses built by the Dutch settlers have very little privacy, as one bedchamber invariably opens into another. In some cases, the sleeping apartments all open into a common sitting room occupied by the family. To English people, this is both an uncomfortable and very unpleasant arrangement. I slept for 2 nights at Mr. Blank's house with my husband, and our dormitory had no egress but through another bedchamber, and as that happened to be occupied on the first night by a clergyman, I had to wait for an hour after my husband was up and downstairs rejoicing in the fresh air of a lovely summer morning before I could escape from my chamber. My neighbor, who was very young and very comely, taking a long time for his prayers and the business of the toilet. My husband laughed very heartily at my imprisonment, as he termed it, but the next day I had the laugh against him, for our sleeping neighbors happened to be a middle-aged Quaker, with a very sickly, delicate wife. I, of course, was forced to go to bed when she did, or be obliged to pass through her chamber after Brother Jonathan had retired for the night. This being by no means desirable, I left a very interesting argument in which my husband, the Quaker, and the poet were fighting an animated battle on reform principles against the clergyman and my very much respected Tory host. How they got on, I don't know, for the debate was at its height when I was obliged to beat my retreat to bed. After an hour or so, I heard Jonathan tumble to bed, and while undressing, he made the following very innocent remark to his wife. "Truly, Hannah, I fear that I have used too many words tonight. My uncle is a man of many words, and one is apt to forget the rules of prudence when arguing with him." If the use of many words was looked upon as a serious transgression by honest Jonathan, my husband, my friend, and the poet must have been very guilty men, for they continued their argument until the small hours ayant the toile. My husband had to pass through the room occupied by the friends in order to reach mine, but he put a bold face upon the matter and plunged at once through the difficulty, the Quaker's nose giving unmistakable notice that he was in the land of Nod. The pale, sickly woman just opened her dreamy black eyes, but hid them instantly beneath the bedclothes, and the passage, not of arms, but of the bedchamber, was won. The next morning we had to rise early to take the boat, and Jonathan was up by the dawn of day, so that I went through as bold as a lion, and was busily employed in discussing an excellent breakfast, while my poor partner was sitting impatiently nursing his appetite at the foot of his bed, and wishing the pale Quakeress across the bay. The steamer was in sight before he was able to join us at the breakfast table. I had now my revenge, and teased him all the way home on being kept a prisoner, with only a sickly woman for a jailer. A young lady gave me an account of a funeral she witnessed in this primitive village, which may not be uninteresting to my English readers as a picture of some of the customs of a new country. The deceased was an old, very respectable resident in the township, and as the Canadians delight in large funerals, he was followed to his last home by nearly all the residents for miles around. The use of the hearse is not known in rural districts, and indeed is seldom used in towns or cities here. The corpse is generally carried to the grave, the bearers being chosen from among the gentlemen of most note in the neighborhood, who, to the honor of the country be it spoken, never refuse to act on these mournful occasions. These walking funerals are far more imposing and affecting spectacles than the hearse with its funeral plumes, and the simple fact of friends and neighbors conveying a departed brother to his long home has a more solemn and touching effect upon the mind than the train of hired mourners and empty state carriages. When a body is brought from a distance for interment, it is conveyed in a wagon, if in summer, spring, or autumn, and on a sleigh during the winter season, and is attended to the grave by all the respectable yeomen in the township. I cannot resist the strong temptation of digressing from my present subject in order to relate a very affecting instance
I witnessed at one of these funerals of the attachment of a dog to his deceased master, which drew tears from my eyes and from the eyes of my children. The body of a farmer had been brought in a wagon from one of the back townships, a distance of 20 or 30 miles, and was, as usual in such cases, attended by a long train of country equipages. My house fronted the churchyard, and from the windows you could witness the whole of the funeral ceremonial, and hear the service pronounced over the grave. When the coffin was lifted by the stalwart sons of the deceased from the wagon, and the procession formed to carry it into the church, I observed a large, buff Flemish dog fall into the ranks of the mourners, and follow them into the sacred edifice, keeping as near the coffin as those about it would permit him. After the service in the church was ended, the creature preserved in following the beloved remains to the grave. When the crowd dispersed, the faithful animal retired to some distance, and laid himself quietly down upon a grave, until the sexton had finished his mournful task, and the last sod was placed upon the fresh heap that had closed for ever over the form he loved. When the man retired, the dog proceeded to the spot, walked carefully around it, smelt the earth, lifted his head, and uttered the most unearthly howls. He then endeavored to disinter the body by digging a large hole at one end of the grave, but finding that he could not effect his purpose, he stretched himself at full length over it, as if to guard the spot, with his head buried between his forepaws, his whole appearance betokening the most intense dejection. All that day and night, and the next day and night, he never quitted his post for an instant, at intervals smelling the earth and uttering those mournful, heart-rending cries. My boys took him bread and meat, and tried to coax him from the grave, but he rejected the food and their caresses. The creature appeared wasted and heartbroken with grief. Towards noon of the third day, the eldest son of his late master came in search of him, and the young man seemed deeply affected by this instance of the dog's attachment to his father. Even his well-known voice failed to entice him from the grave, and he was obliged to bring a collar and chain and lift him by force into his wagon to get him from his post. O human love! Is thy memory and thy faith greater than the attachment of this poor, and as we term him, unreasoning brute, to his dead master? His grief made an impression on my mind, and on that of my children, which will never be forgotten. But to return to the village funeral. The body in this case was borne to the church by the near relatives of the deceased, and the clergyman of the establishment delivered a funeral sermon in which he enumerated the good qualities of the departed, his long residence among them, and described the trials and hardships he had encountered as a first settler in that district, while it was yet in the wilderness. He extolled his conduct as a good citizen and faithful Christian, and a public-spirited man. His sermon was a very complete piece of rural biography, very curious and graphic in its way, and was listened to with the deepest attention by the persons assembled. When the discourse was concluded and the blessing pronounced, one of the sons of the deceased rose and informed the persons present that if anyone wished to take a last look of the dear old man, now was the time. He then led the way to the aisle in which the coffin stood upon the trestles, and opening a small lid in the top, revealed to the astonishment of my young friend the pale, ghastly face of the dead. Almost every person present touched either the face, hands, or brow of the deceased, and after their curiosity had been fully satisfied, their procession followed the remains to their last resting place. This part of the ceremony concluded, the indifferent spectators dispersed to their respective homes, while the friends and relations of the dead man returned to dine at the house of one of his sons, my friend making one of the party. In solemn state, the mourners discussed the merits of an excellent dinner, the important business of eating being occasionally interrupted by remarks upon the appearance of the corpse, his age, the disease of which he died, the probable division of his property, and the merits of the funeral discourse. This was done in such a business-like, matter-of-fact manner that my friend was astonished how the blood relations of the deceased could join in these remarks, After the great business of eating was concluded, the spirits of the party began to flag. The master of the house, perceiving how matters were going, left the room, and soon returned with a servant bearing a tray with plates and fork, and a large dish of hickory nuts. The mourners dried their tears, and set seriously to work to discuss the nuts, and while deeply engaged with their mouse-like employment, forgot for a while their sorrow for the dead, continuing to keep up their spirits until the announcement of tea turned their thoughts into a new channel. By the time all the rich pies, cakes, and preserves were eaten, their feelings seemed to have subsided into their accustomed everyday routine. It is certain that death is looked upon by many Canadians more as a matter of business and a change of property into other hands than as a real domestic calamity. I have heard people talk of the approaching dissolution of their nearest ties with a calm philosophy which I never could comprehend. "My mother is old and delicate. We can't expect her to last long," says one.
"My brother's death has been looked for these several months past. You know, he's in the consumption."
My husband asked the son of a respectable farmer, for whom he entertained an esteem, how his father was, for he had not seen him for some time.
"I guess," was the reply, "that the old man's fixin' for the other world."
Another young man, being asked by my friend, Captain Blank, to spend the evening at his house, replied,
"No, can't, much obliged, but I'm afeard that grandfather will give the last kicks while I'm away."
Canadians flock in crowds to visit the dying and to gaze upon the dead. A doctor told me that being called into the country to visit a very sick man, he was surprised on finding the wife of his patient sitting alone before the fire in the lower room, smoking a pipe. He naturally inquired if her husband was better.
"Oh, no, sir, far from that. He is dying."
"Dying, and you here?"
"I can't help that, sir. The room is so crowded with the neighbors that I can't get in to wait upon him."
"Follow me," said the doctor. "I'll soon make a clearance for you."
On ascending the stairs that led to the apartment of the sick man, he found them crowded with people struggling to get in to take a peep at the poor man. It was only by telling them that he was the doctor that he forced his way to the bedside. He found his patient in a high fever, greatly augmented by the bustle, confusion, and heat occasioned by so many people around him. With great difficulty he cleared the room of these intruders, and told the brother of his patient to keep everyone but the sick man's wife out of the house. The brother followed the doctor's advice, and the man cheated the curiosity of the death-seekers and recovered. The Canadians spend a great deal of money upon their dead. An old lady told me that her nephew, a very large farmer, who had the misfortune to lose his wife in childbed, had laid out a great deal of money, a little fortune, she termed it, on her grave clothes. "Oh, my dear," she said, "it is a thousand pities that you did not go and see her before she was buried. She was dressed so expensively, and she made such a beautiful corpse. Her cap was of real thread lace, trimmed with white French ribbons, and her linen the finest that could be bought in the country." The more ostentatious the display of grief for the dead, the less I have always found of the reality. I heard two young ladies who had recently lost a mother, not more than 16 years older than the eldest of the twain, lamenting most pathetically that they could not go to a public ball because they were in mourning for Ma. Oh, what a pitiful farce is this, of wearing mourning for the dead! But as I have a good deal to say to sensible people on that subject, I will defer my long lecture until the next chapter.
Random Thoughts. When is youth's gay heart the lightest? When the torch of health burns brightest, and the soul's rich banquet lies in air and ocean, earth and skies, till the honeyed cup of pleasure overflows with mental treasure. When is love's sweet dream the sweetest? When a kindred heart thou meetest, unpolluted with the strife, the selfish aims that tarnish life, ere the scowl of care has faded, the shining chaplet fancy braided, and emotions pure and high swell the heart and fill the eye, rich revealings of a mind within a loving breast enshrined, to thine own fond bosom plighted, in affection's bonds united, The sober joys of after years are nothing to those smiles and fears. When is sorrow's sting the strongest? When friends grow cold, we've loved the longest, and the bankrupt heart would borrow treacherous hopes to cheat the morrow, dreams of bliss by reason banished, early joys that quickly vanished, and the treasured past appears only to augment our tears, when, within itself retreating, the spirit owns life's joys are fleeting. Yet, racked with anxious doubts and fears, trusts, blindly trusts, to future years. Oh, this is grief, the preacher saith, the world's dark woe that worketh death. Yet, oft beneath its influence bowed, a beam of hope will burst the cloud, and heaven's celestial shore appears, slow rising o'er the tide of years, guiding the spirit's darkling way through thorny paths to endless day. Then the toils of life are done, youth and age are both as one, sorrow nevermore can sting, neglect or pain the bosom wring, and the joys blessed spirits prove far exceeds all earthly love.
End of chapter 7.